Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Taylor Swift, Thekla and Tidal. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
And hello, listeners. Thanks for coming back. If you did, thanks for listening for the first time, if you are. And no thanks if you didn't bother listening to this episode. You'll never know I said that, so you're missing out already.
Have you got used to the new theme tune yet? Has it become that that's just the theme tune?
I don't even remember what the old theme tune sounded like.
You blotted it from your memory.
It's all right. It's in my head now.
Oh, it's now come back.
I thought I didn't
pulled
remember
it out of your memory slot. I think I'm close to getting that I'm now living with it. And yeah, that's the theme tune to our podcast. But I'm still not quite there. It does worry me. I've remembered.
You're saying this like we just listened to it.
Well, we did. Well, our listeners did. So they'll know what I'm talking about, even if you don't. I was reminded a couple of weeks ago that in 1989, Signal Radio, Stoke-on-Trent, changed all of its jingles. And from that point onwards, it was a bit rubbish. And up until then, it was my favourite radio station. And the day they changed their jingles, something changed. And I fell out of that radio station and I never listened again, really. And so I sort of worry that that could have happened. I forgot when you insisted that we have a new theme tune, that's the power of the jingle.
Yeah, although Signal Radio's old jingles were amazing.
It is true that after the revamp in 1989, they could no longer play the 3-minute Signal song that is the greatest radio jingle that has ever been made. So perhaps that's what it was, that I realised I'm never going to hear that ever again. Because this is pre the World Wide Web, remember?
Yeah.
So you couldn't just Google it and find it out there on the internet. I'm never going to hear this ever again. And so that's it. I'm just not going to listen to this radio station anymore. I'm going to change my loyalties to MFM in Wrexham, which I think is what I did.
Did they have a 3-minute jingle?
They did not have a 3-minute jingle.
Well, that doesn't make any sense.
But they did appoint a certain Chris Cook to do a weekly pop gossip slot.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of him. He sounds awful.
So that's how my career has progressed since I was 17 years old. When I was 17, I used to sit down for a few minutes and talk nonsense about that week's pop music. But now...
Did you just read out that week's look-in?
I think it was Smash Hits. I think I graduated beyond look-in by that point. That was a few years later. That wasn't 1989. That was sort of early 90s. Yeah, it was mainly Smash Hits. There was another magazine called Number One that was sort of the poor man's Smash Hits, if you can imagine such a thing.
Number One, yeah.
So I used to combine... Well, Number One was the first bit of pop journalism I ever had published.
Was it?
They used to have a comedy lyrics slot. Mm. Where you could send in comedy lyrics.
You're using journalism quite loosely.
And I sent... Do you remember Bross? They're back, aren't they? Aren't they back selling out the O2 or something?
Yeah, probably.
That's what the press release said. Well, when Bross were big, they had a song called I Quit.
Yeah.
I think it was on the first album.
Yeah.
I think it was called Push. Was it called Push?
I don't know.
The first Bross album. And so my comedy lyrics were Matt Goss. Matt Goss was the singer, wasn't he? Not Luke Goss.
Well, they both sang, didn't they?
Did they? Whichever one was the front man.
Well, wasn't the point that they were both the front men?
No, not really. I think the other one played guitar, didn't he? Anyway, let's say it was Matt Goss who was doing the vocals. Matt Goss, colon, I quit. Rest of the world, colon, good. And that was my... I won a £10 record token for that. That's my words. That's the highest word count rate I've ever received. A £10 record token. How would it be? Matt Goss, I quit. Rest of the world. Nine words, £10.
That is pretty good.
On a record token. Mm. Someone told me they're bringing record tokens back. Who told me that? I think it was a reliable source, but not so reliable that I can remember.
Why? What?
I'm sure I heard they're bringing record tokens back. I will research that, because if they are...
Well, can't you... I'm sure you can go into any independent record shop and say, give me a voucher for your shop.
Are you sure of that?
I'm certain of it.
Every independent record shop in the world
all
will have
them.
Their own tokens.
I mean, what about...
When they say, okay...
When you say bringing... You say, like, record tokens weren't, like, green shield stamped. They were just... things, weren't they? Like,
well, no, but every record shop accepted them. That was the point. You could spend them in any shop that sold records, more or less. And then I think
remember that.
That was the whole point, that you weren't saying you have to go and spend your money in HMV or Woolworths or Smiths.
I remember getting Woolworths vouchers. I don't remember.
I have a feeling, I think one of the big retailers pulled out of record tokens. It may have been Woolworths. I can say that because they're dead, so we can libel them. More on libel later, by the way.
If we ever get out of this hole.
If we ever get out of this hole. But I think it was Woolworths or Smiths or somebody pulled out of record tokens, and that was sort of brought about the end of them. Anyway, we may be here talking about the return of the record token based on me
that
having dreamt that. Perhaps I dreamt it.
You must have done.
It's possible I dreamt it, or I was at an event where it was mooted. I'll do some research for next week, and I'll tell you whether or not record tokens are coming back.
I don't believe it.
Something to look forward
to. Right, well, that's next week's podcast, Zoid. This week,
yeah,
we're going to talk about why Bristol venue Thekla is under the threat of closure. And the addition of detailed credits to tracks on Tidal. But first, Taylor Swift and, as you just mentioned, some libel ding-dongs.
So she's got a new record out.
Yeah.
Which is why she's everywhere again. Apparently she's windrowing that off the streaming services, but only probably for a week or two. That's what we've been told.
Yeah.
Don't know if that's true. I don't really care.
No.
But anyway, she's got a new record out, so there's been all sorts of Taylor Swift nonsense in the news this week. But the one that caught our eye was a dispute between Taylor Swift and her lawyers. We don't actually know how involved Taylor Swift was in writing this letter. But Taylor Swift and her lawyers and a blogger who wrote a blog about Taylor Swift.
Yes. So Taylor Swift, as you say, Taylor Swift in inverted commas, certainly Taylor Swift's legal team, issued a cease and desist letter to a blog called Popfront, which published an article discussing the alt-right's admiration for her and her failure to disavow any right-wing sympathies she almost certainly, I'm sure, does not have. Just to cover myself any legal letters that I can't be bothered dealing with. But this has backfired, because the blog, in collaboration with the American Civil Liberties Union, not only published that letter, but published a response saying that the letter's nonsense. There's nothing defamatory about this blog post, and this is an abuse of the law on the part of Taylor Swift's lawyers. It's a good example of the Streisand effect, whereby you try to make people not look at something, and then they all look at it. And more people look at it than would have looked at it had you not said anything at all.
Yeah, because I'd never come across this particular blog before.
It's quite new. It's only got a few posts on it.
So it's called Pop Front, and it's aiming to sort of talk about music, but also politics and sort of where the two collide. I think that's sort of the remit. I'm basing that on its slogan. I can't remember what its slogan is, but it implies that it's going to be a little bit of sort of left-leaning politics, a bit of pop music, all collided. And so, as you say, the article was looking at how certain people in the bloody alt-right movement in America have been analysing Taylor Swift lyrics and basically saying, yeah, that lyric that Taylor Swift wrote, that's her approving of everything we believe in, and she's standing up for what we believe in. And various alt-right people have been writing about this and saying this. And so this was a blog commenting on that, and then also providing a potted history of the white supremacist movement, past and present. And as you say, ultimately saying, we all know Taylor Swift as an artist has generally chosen to not express her political opinions in public.
Yes.
And what the blog was basically saying was, okay, that's a decision you've made as an artist. But when you have people over here whose politics a lot of people find offensive, claiming that you are somehow endorsing their politics through your music, then you should be standing up and saying, no, you've got that wrong. That is not what my lyrics say. So that was the basic gist of this blog.
And where they got into the particular defamation accusations was that this blog, it goes, as you say, it talks about discussions that are already going on. It's saying how like Breitbart and places like that have taken like the lyrics of Look What You Made Me Do and said like these lyrics are her saying that our movement is good and we're right to be doing all this stuff. And then Popfront takes that and says, look, yeah, actually, if you do analyse these lyrics, they do appear to uphold a white supremacist view. The video for Look What You Made Me Do has stuff in it that looks like fascist imagery, certainly plays on that. And so, I mean, it doesn't go as far as saying Taylor Swift is a racist, but it gets very, very, very close to it.
But I suppose in defence of the blog, its conclusion is not, therefore, I think Taylor Swift is sympathetic to the alt-right movement or the white supremacist movement, but the conclusion is because you can take the alt-right's interpretation of your lyrics and your videos and see what they mean, then you should abandon this commitment to not be political and come out and actually say, shut up, all you alt-right people, I am not on your side. And that was basically the radical at the end of the piece. But Taylor Swift's people, as you say, not impressed, felt that it was representing her as perhaps being sympathetic to this movement and said that that was defamatory. It was quite a long, stern legal letter that they sent.
Yes.
They didn't expect us to ever see that because the last paragraph of that letter went into great emphasis that this letter must not be published or made public. And then it was claiming the laws of confidence and the laws of copyright, basically saying there is copyright in this letter and so therefore you can't share this letter with anybody because to do so would be copyright infringement. But the blogger, who I assume like most bloggers, doesn't have easy access to a legal team. And you assume that when the media law firms who tend to work for big name celebrities or for big corporations, when they send these letters to bloggers or to small independent websites, sort of they're assuming these people can't afford to take legal counsel. The easiest thing for them to do will be to remove it. They actually wanted a retraction as well, didn't they?
Which, yes.
I always think when they ask for a retraction or an apology or whatever, as you say, it's not a particularly widely read blog. Or it wasn't. It is now. So almost just ask for the content to be removed rather than asking for a retraction, because why do you need there to be a retraction? Anyway, that's what it was demanding. But this blogger took the case to the ACLU and said, are these lawyers onto anything? And so the ACLU's lawyers had a look at it and they reckoned that it, well, what they're basically saying was it misrepresents what the law says about defamation and therefore it was an assault on this blogger's free speech. As you know, this is a particular bugbear of mine, so I'm not here to comment on this specific case. I do actually find the ACLU's arguments very compelling.
Yep.
They also wrote a very long letter, so yes, there are two very long letters
both
that they can
of
look
which
at.
You can read online.
Both of which are on the ACLU's website, so they've published both of them, and I find their arguments very compelling. Having said that, I've not looked at the two articles in huge detail. Also, I have no particular expertise in American libel law, so I'm not really making any comment on this case. Having said that, we ourselves, and we know other people this has happened to, have received legal letters from lawyers representing big corporations or millionaire celebrities demanding content be removed, claiming defamation. And I'm not a media law expert, but I know quite a lot about libel and slander and defamation. And so sometimes I read these letters and it's like, I am pretty damn sure that there is absolutely no case for libel. And there's been a couple of examples where they've come to us and it's more than I'm pretty damn sure. There is absolutely no case for libel in this article that we have published. Indeed, we've published articles which aren't even particularly contentious.
No.
Not, you know, delving in some contentious issues like this blog post was, where they're saying, oh, this is libelous, remove it. And you sense that they are assuming that we can't afford to go and get legal advice because we can't for something like that. So we'll just say, oh, for an easy life, we'll just take this content down and they win. And my personal viewpoint on this, I sort of get over the top on this sometimes, but when I get letters like that and it's like, there is no case for libel and it's so clear cut, I can't believe that you, as a media lawyer, believe there is a case for libel. Because if you do, then you're stupid. And I don't believe you've got to where you are if you're stupid. So I suspect that you don't think there's a case for libel either. You would never take this case to court. You know, if we just ignored you, there's no way you would actually sue us because you know there isn't a case to go before a judge. But you are assuming that for an easy life, or just because we're frightened and we can't afford to get legal advice. I remember when I did my law degree, one of the lecturers saying, the law is open to everybody, just like the Ritz Hotel is open to everybody. It's there, you can go and access it if you can afford to pay. And obviously, often we can't afford to pay. And so you assume what these lawyers are doing is they're saying, OK, we'll send this stern letter and we'll frighten them. Or just for an easy life, they'll take the content down and then our millionaire celebrity client or our big corporation client, they'll get what they want, content removed off the internet, and hurrah, we can bill them for that, job done. But my perception on that is, if a lawyer is knowingly misrepresenting the law for the benefit of their millionaire client, that's just wrong.
Yes.
And that shouldn't be allowed. And if the legal profession had any credibility, which it doesn't really, but if the legal profession had any credibility, any lawyer caught doing that, of deliberately misrepresenting the law, knowing that what they're saying in the letter is wrong, because they think they can force some content off the internet, they should be sacked. They should be banned from practicing law for life. Their firm should be fined millions and millions of pounds. Any partner at the business who is aware of it, they should be sacked and banned from practicing law for life. Because it's an assault on free speech. And that's what the ACLU are saying. And saying, I'm not particularly commenting on this case because I don't know enough about it. But they are right. This does go on. You get these lawyers working for millionaires and big corporations who are basically attacking free speech with these threatening, stern letters that misrepresent the law, knowingly misrepresent the law. And we all know there are plenty of journalists and editors and publications that publish articles based on gossip they haven't researched, or just outright lie sometimes, or twist the facts. We all know that the media is not perfect by any means, but, you know, the legal profession should rise above that. So I am, even though I'm not commenting on the specific case, I am very sympathetic with, and perhaps that's why I'm therefore persuaded by their arguments, because I very much agree with what ACLU are saying, which is there is, and we're not talking about sort of Saul Goodman type lawyers here, we're talking about big media law firms who routinely send out these letters, and they shouldn't. They should fuck off. Well, they shouldn't fuck off. They should tell their clients to fuck off. I think that's the thing, isn't it? You can tell what's happened. The millionaire clients come in. It's like, oh, I'm really angry about this article. And rather than just saying, for God's sake, grow up. Sometimes, if you're a celebrity, people will say things you don't like. Just grow up and get over it. Oh, it's the internet age. Write your own blog post response. You've got a much bigger audience than anyone else does. But rather than saying that, they say, yeah, we'll write a stern letter for $5,000. So,
well, going back to this case and echoing what you've just said, so Popfront, as well as having this letter sent for them by ACLU, Popfront posted a new article about the case and what was happening. And in their conclusion of this, they said, the press should not be bullied by high-paid lawyers or frightened into submission by legal jargon. These scare tactics may have worked for Taylor in the past, but I am not backing down.
So good. I'm assuming you're in the right, you may not be. And I think we should clarify once again, nobody here at all, in any way, shape or form, is suggesting that Taylor Swift has a racist view in her brain at all. And if she doesn't want to speak about politics, that's the artist's right. We can't force them to. I think perhaps there is a point in this original blog post that, okay, you shouldn't have to comment on politics, but you've been forced into a position where perhaps on this one occasion you should. But I respect an artist's right to not be overtly political. That's their creative right. But lawyers, stop abusing the law. Don't be liars for hire. I think that's what I'm saying, isn't it? Don't be a liar for hire. If the only way you can make money out of law is to be a liar for hire, don't be a lawyer.
Yeah.
There are other jobs. Do a podcast. Can't make any money out of podcasts. Can in America. Some American podcasters make money, don't they?
Yes, go and do a podcast in America instead of being a lawyer. I'm sure it will be similar, similar salary.
Most of the lawyers I was talking about are in the UK, whereas obviously the lawyer in this story is in the US. We're yet to have a comment from Taylor Swift on this, let alone response to the original blog on the cease and desist thing. But this whole debacle has had a flurry of coverage, it coming the week. I mean, I assume, because actually this all kicked off a few weeks ago, so I don't know whether the ACLU deliberately decided to go public just in the build-up to the album release, or whether that's a coincidence. But it has had quite a lot of coverage, and she could ultimately distance herself from it and say, oh, I didn't know this was happening. I think perhaps you should be aware this is happening in your name, but she might say, oh, I wasn't really involved in that, and then sort of blame it on the lawyers. Or perhaps she will just refuse to comment on this story as well. But if you are listening, Taylor, shout at your lawyers.
Yeah.
Have a word with your lawyers and tell them, respond to the ACLU, because they're demanding that basically Taylor Swift and her lawyers say to ACLU, yeah, you're right, or you're wrong, by a certain deadline. At least the ACLU's deadline, the last amusing thing about this whole story, at least the deadline the ACLU set in their letter for Taylor Swift and her legal team to respond to their arguments was after the letter was sent.
Yeah. Yes.
Where obviously Taylor Swift's lawyers, either it was a typo or they wrote the letter, then sat on it for a week and then forgot to update it. The deadline they gave for this blog to remove the post and put the retraction was the day before the letter had been written, according to the date on the letter. That was slightly amusing.
Potentially more to come from that story. Potentially it will slip away into the dust. But we'll see. In the meantime, you probably can't listen to Taylor Swift's new album, so let's all just sit in silence.
Or listen to our super jingle instead.
Still to come, how Tidal is leading the way in telling you who played bassoon on your favourite tracks, and some news in brief. But now, let's talk about Thekla, the boat-based live music venue in Bristol.
I must admit, although this is a very popular venue and a lot of concern about what we're about to talk about, I've never actually been to this venue. Have you ever been to this venue?
No, but I've never been to Bristol either.
Have you ever been to Bristol?
I don't think so.
Really? Oh, I'm going to be doing a CMU DIY urban development event in Bristol later this month. Should come to that.
No.
But it's not on this venue. Matt, our producer, has been to this venue. So yes. Really, he should be doing this story because he has personal experience. But so it does exist. We can therefore confirm it does exist.
It does definitely exist.
One person involved in Setlist has actually
say been it on. Exists.
For now, that's the point of
and
this
I've
story.
And I've looked at it on Google Street View.
Okay. So this is yet another grassroots venue that could be under threat because of some bloody property developers building a big set of residential flats right next to it.
Yes, there are proposals to build a whole new development, commercial space and flats and an outdoor area.
The boat is in a canal, don't think we said that, so obviously...
Yes, it's on the opposite side of the canal.
And they like building flats next to canals these days, don't they?
Yes, and the concern is that they haven't properly considered the noise from the venue in designing these flats, and therefore once they're built, the people who move into those flats will complain about the noise. That will potentially have an effect on the licensing of the venue, either the license being revoked or new stipulations. I mean, in the past, things like this have meant that venues have to reduce their noise or reduce their opening hours, and then if you have to reduce the noise, you can't really put on live music. If you reduce the opening hours, you can't make money on the bar, and they ultimately end up having to shut down because of these complaints of these people who moved in after the venue got there.
Yeah, the classic thing where people choose to live in a part of town because it's kind of cool, because look, there's a music venue. And then when they move in, they're like, yeah, that music venue is a bit noisy. And so they start moaning to their local council until the venue is basically bureaucrated out of business. Is that possible, to be bureaucrated out of business?
It is now.
It was stories like this that have occurred in various cities around the country that in part inspired the creation of this thing called the Music Venue Trust that has been campaigning to try and introduce various measures to make it easier for grassroots venues to operate. And they are very much supporting DHP, which is the company that runs this venue, in trying to make sure that this residential development doesn't affect the running of this venue in the future. And I suppose they're being quite positive in saying, because this is still early days for this new property, because they're still getting their planning, there's still an opportunity here to have venue, swanky new residential apartments, and for the two to happily coexist. It all comes down to how they design the property, but they have to get that right now, because there's nothing we can do about this in 5 years' time. And the concern is neither the property developers nor the council are ensuring that the right work is being done now to ensure there'll be no problems later.
Yes, so there was a planning meeting at the council last week, and the result of that was that the proposal was waved through, so it's got its planning permission. But the developer assured the councillors that it would do a proper sound survey before doing any building work, and everything would be fine. And the council said, oh, that's great, that sounds really good, off you go. DHP tried to get the decision deferred until that survey had been done and the developers had updated their plans to accommodate the noise of the venue. But the council said, no, I'm sure they'll definitely do that. It'll all be fine. So go ahead and get on with it.
They had already done one little survey of the sound around the venue.
Yes, they did that the weekend before the planning meeting, and DHP described that as woefully inadequate.
And almost that increased their concern. The fact that they thought, oh good, they're coming to do this little investigation prior to the council meeting on this planning application. That's good. But then after that, they were like, oh my God, was that it? Now we're even more concerned. So there was a sort of real rally call ahead of this planning meeting for the music community to get behind this, which they did. It's a very popular venue. And crucially, now that it's sort of gone through, but these promises have been made, what DHP and the Music Venue Trust are now saying is, hey, music community, we need you to continue supporting us on this because we need to do everything we can to make sure that these property developers come good on their commitments and the council are looking and saying, hey, hang on a second, where's this investigation? Tell us what you're doing to your design. Make sure you're going to get this right.
Yeah, because I suppose there are two issues here. One is the developers build. I mean, this isn't always the case, but often developers go in, they build a place, and then once they finish building it, they sell it and they're gone. So what does it matter to them if there are issues with surrounding buildings later?
It will usually take a couple of years before the people have moved in and they start moaning and complaining to the council, and then suddenly there are licensing issues. And by that point, the proper developer's long gone.
The other issue is that councils don't always recognise the value of their nighttime industries, in particular music venues. And as you said earlier, often music venues move into a cheap bit of town that's not necessarily very nice because it's cheap. And then around them builds a kind of a cultural community and other businesses come in, and then it gets cool. And that's when the property developers come in because that area has become cool. And then you have these issues with the thing that made it cool being closed down.
Of course, moves are afoot at a national level to have the so-called agent of change principle put into national law that would force property developers to have to do the work and spend the money. I suppose that's the crucial thing, isn't it? Not only do we need these property developers to properly research the sound issues and make sure they design to complement that, that will probably mean them spending more money.
Yeah.
So not only do we need them to do the research, we probably then need them to spend more money. But this agent of change principle would force property developers to do that work and to spend that money where they are coming in next to a pre-existing music venue. There has been some progress on that and a few tweaks to the law already, although it is something that on a national level, people like UK Music and Music Venue Trust are pushing to get a much more resolute bit of law on the statute book so that we're not reliant on planning councils of local authorities that may or may not be helpful on this.
Yeah, I mean, it's not always negative. Actually, a positive example this year was Club Eifer back in Cardiff, which became under threat of closure because property developers wanted to knock down the building next door and build flats there. And the design for those flats had no provisions for soundproofing whatsoever. And there was a big campaign about that. I mean, it had knock-on effect. There are other venues in the same street that it was potentially going to have a knock-on effect for, but these flats would be basically connected to this venue. Ultimately, the campaign was successful. The proposals were withdrawn. And Cardiff Council is in the process of buying the land that Club Eifer Back stands on so that it can lease it back to the venue and give it greater protection in the future should a similar thing happen. So Cardiff Council, definitely one of the ones that do recognise the value of music venues and other nighttime businesses.
And in that case, the local MPs, who obviously aren't a direct decision maker on any of this, but got behind that. So there's an element of, as well as lobbying your council, also lobby any politicians in your area and make sure they're on side and they are making these demands. So I suppose the thing to say is to follow Fecla on the social medias of your choice. And so when they are at moments where they need your help, then you can sign whatever petition and send whatever emails you do. So you should be following them on Twitter, Facebook, etc.
Don't tweet them and ask them why they don't just float the boat off somewhere else.
I think
that's been happening quite a lot. Their issue is that they're quite a large ship on a well-populated canal. There aren't that many places they could move it to, and the ones they could move it to are too close, ironically, to residential buildings.
Yeah, so don't be thinking you've got the killer solution there. They've already thought of that. It's not an option. The option is to get this building designed right.
Just quickly, time for some news in brief now. Web blocking is coming to the USA at last.
Yeah, web blocking. We've talked about that on the podcast quite a bit. Actually, on the CMU Insights blog, this week just gone, we published a little summary of the key piracy stories from the last 12 months that have been happening. And that has an explanation of where we are on web blocking. But the interesting development in the last 7 days, this actually has nothing to do with music, because it's what they sometimes call the Pirate Bay of Science. Mm. So it's a website that illegally shares academic papers without license. And there was a copyright infringement case against them in the US, but they're not based in the US. Classic problem. And so in the injunction that was passed by the court last week, there is a line in there basically calling on internet service providers, and indeed any internet company involved in connecting people with this site, to stop doing so, which basically is a web block injunction. There are no web block injunctions in the US. When Congress tried to put web blocking on the statute book back in 2011-2012, Wikipedia shut down. I don't know if you remember that. It was insane. And so they completely abandoned it. So unlike a lot of European countries where web blocking is now a thing, it is not in the US. Although technically through this landmark judgment it is, we still await the ISP's response if and when the plaintiff in this case tries to enforce that injunction.
A collection of streaming companies have set up a new lobbying group called Digital Music Europe to do some of that good lobbying we were discussing last week.
You can never have too many trade bodies. So yes, Spotify's in this. Deezer is in this, SoundCloud is in this, also a couple of companies who provide services to the sort of digital music streaming space. And so it's to make sure that their voices are heard in Brussels. Things like the copyright directive that we've been talking about, they'll have opinions on that, but also a whole load of other stuff that's happening on a European level. Privacy, law, geo-blocking. So it'll be interesting to see if their views are the same as the music industry's lobbyists or whether they're sometimes up against the music industry's lobbyists. We'll see.
Jedward. We're in the High Court in Ireland recently. It was quite an interesting case, although what got more coverage was Jedward taking selfies with their lawyer in his wig and everything. That was quite funny. And Jedward Snapchatting from the court, which almost, but not quite, landed them in hot water.
Yeah, so this was a complicated dispute over a merchandise business that never happened. which actually was settled on the second day. So they had a day of everyone presenting their arguments, and then they settled overnight. So it was all over really quickly. But in the day when Jedward were there, they were sort of documenting the day on their social media. At one point, they somehow announced that Jedward had entered the building. I don't know whether that was them shouting it on their social media, I don't know. And yeah, they were filming little Snapchat videos as they went around, which is not the done thing in the High Court in Dublin, or the Four Courts Complex, as they call it. Although it was quite interesting that the son, or the Irish son, went to the body that administrates the courts. And they basically said, well, it sort of breaks our protocol, but they only took videos of themselves. They didn't actually take the videos in the courtroom. No one else was in the videos, so all right then, whatever. But then the son were going, but they're in really deep trouble, aren't they? And it was sort of like, well, probably not. It's like, no, but the judge could put them in contempt of court, couldn't they? It's like, well, probably not. So it wasn't quite as big as...
Ultimately, the court said, well, had they filmed anything other than their own faces, then yes, probably. But they just took some selfies and we'll let them off.
But they don't want to encourage this. For the next round of pop stars who go to fight cases in the Irish courts, they would rather you not turn it into a social media extravaganza.
So you can read more on all of those stories and all the stories we discussed this week. If you go to setlistpodcast.com, you'll find the show notes for this show and links to all of them. And finally this week, Tidal is bringing old-fashioned liner notes to the internet. So you'll finally be able to know who did what on your favourite songs, which is something that has been a bit of a bone of contention, particularly for producers and songwriters, for a long time now. I mean, since before streaming services.
Yeah, when everything went digital in the early days of downloads and the iTunes boom, it was felt that the old liner notes, and by that, we're really talking about the credits. Because liner notes also had background information and stuff like that sometimes, didn't it? But we're talking about the credits that you would always get on the physical release somewhere in the packaging. There would be who wrote all the songs, who the producers were, who the mastering engineers were, and all of that. And then usually there would be some random thank yous and little messages in the credits. And obviously that was part of the physical experience. And when everything went digital, most of that was lost.
Yeah.
So obviously the metadata that comes with the track will always tell you who the artist is, but doesn't often have any of that other information. And as you say, songwriters and record producers and the other people involved feel that that's not a good thing, partly because actually within copyright law, there is a moral right to attribution that says that people who are involved in the creation, particularly on the songwriting side, should be credited. So arguably there's a moral obligation to do this. Another argument that's been put forward is, okay, not everybody, but sort of geeky music fans quite like to navigate music by the people involved behind the scenes. And almost as an opportunity here in the digital age versus the old credits on a piece of paper, that really I should be able to go in and say, oh, that's interesting. That songwriter was involved in this track. I'm going to click on that songwriter's name. It's like, wow, look at all these other songs that writer was involved in. I didn't know. Click on the producer's name. Wow, this producer's career is more interesting than the artist's career. I'm going to go and listen to these records because I now know who produced them. And that's a huge opportunity that the streaming services have never been able to capitalise on because they've never had this listing information.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. In the days of CDs, there were lots of artists and people I discovered through having these whole other careers, hopefully having gone, oh, they played cello on this track or did whatever, or they co-wrote this track. And then you go and find the rest of their career and go, oh, actually, they might be part of another band. They might just have done a lot of interesting stuff. But yeah, that, you don't really get that with streaming, except on Tidal now, where you get, I mean, if anything, too much information.
I don't think that's fair.
No, it's not. No, it's all right. I'm being facetious. But it's, there's a lot of information that they've gone to the other extreme, because as well as credits like composers, lyricists, engineers, other musicians, vocals, instrumentalists, mastering engineers, producers, mixers, record labels, the person who took the cover photography, and other bits of credit information.
But most of which you would have found on a CD cover in the old
days. But there's also a list of samples, which you probably would have got in the thing. It will also include key quotes from music critics about releases. So there's a lot of, having gone from no data to a lot of data, it's quite a leap. And one that songwriters and producers in particular will be happy about.
As you say, it's been a long-term bugbear, particularly for record producers and songwriters. And the songwriters have become a lot more vocal on this in recent years and saying we should have this information. And various music publishers have also stood up and say, yes, this information should be in there. Although, arguably, although you could now say Tidal have disproven this, but one of the reasons why that data isn't there in Spotify and Apple Music and Deezer and all the rest is because they don't know where to get the data from. It comes back to the classic music database issue that we've talked about numerous times on this podcast, the fact that there is no one-stop database where they can pull all this information. They can pull it off crowdsourced websites. There are crowdsourced databases out there, but are those 100% accurate? And a songwriter wouldn't want to be miscredited from it coming from a crowdsourced service. But the music industry doesn't provide all of this data. The record companies who pump the audio into these services, they don't provide this data. So that's one of the reasons why this hasn't happened. So when music publishers stand up and say, why aren't you crediting songwriters? It's sort of like, well, why haven't you built the database that makes this a really easy thing to do? But Tidal have got the information, so it's obviously, it is possible to do this. They're slowly rolling it out across the catalogue, so it's not 100% of the tracks in there yet, but they are doing this. In some ways, a good move for Tidal, because when Jay-Z bought what was Wimp and rebranded it, he very much pushed it as, we're going to be the artist-friendly streaming service, yeah. We're going to pay you more, we're going to involve you more. And to a certain extent, they're on very similar deals. They may be paying a fraction more than everyone else, but they're basically on the same deals as everybody else. So they're not that much more artist-friendly than any other streaming service. But this is definitely an artist, songwriter, record producer-friendly thing to invest time and money into doing.
And something it would be nice to see other streaming services replicate, because clearly you can't argue now, oh, it's just, you know, the data's not there, we can't do it, because Tidal's got the data, so you can get it too. And it is a useful thing. I mean, not everyone's going to bother to click to go through and see who mastered their favourite song, but I would, and I would like to see that information. So I'm not a Tidal subscriber, so
is this enough to make Spotify. You a Tidal subscriber?
No.
You see, you could say, if you wanted to be cynical, given that it is my opinion that for a streaming service to be commercially viable long term, they need well in excess of 100 million paying subscribers, and the only two services at the moment who have any chance of being that big are Spotify and Apple, and possibly Amazon. So the other services like Tidal, I don't see them having a long-term commercially viable business model. No. Unless they find a different way of operating and do different deals with the music industry.
And they have with their high-quality service and this, they're sort of, I guess they're continuing to position themselves as a real kind of audiophiles streaming service.
I know, but that's
I don't think that is going to, they're clearly trying to operate at scale as well. So that's not going to be, it's not a long-term a viable business.
What I was going to say was, perhaps they ultimately see themselves being bought by somebody else. That's the end game. But why would Spotify or Apple or Amazon buy Tidal? They have all that content. They have the artist contacts. Well, if Tidal has this fantastic database of credit information, that's really valuable. That might be a reason for buying Tidal and then merging it in with one of the other streaming services. But anyway, well done, Tidal. Our podcast on Tidal, it's not, is it? I think it's probably the one service. Do they have podcasts on Tidal? We don't know. We've never used it. It's a shame. We could have had complete credits for the Setlist podcast if we were on Tidal.
I'm going to give you complete credits in a minute's time.
There were not many people involved. Although, in the credits you're about to give, you don't get your jingle composition credit.
Or my artwork composition
credit. Or your artwork composition credit. So it would be in your interest to have detailed credits available somewhere online. Hey, do those credits.
Well, that is it for the show this week. If you go to the show notes, as you were talking about services where it can be found, if you go to the show notes at setlistpodcast.com, you'll find links to everywhere that you could possibly go to subscribe to this podcast. And in many of those places, you can rate and review the show as well, which you might like to. I'm just saying.
Let us know what you think about the jingle.
Yeah.
It's not as good as the Signal song.
Review the jingle.
Circa 1988. That is a great jingle, but it's pretty damn good. So get that into the review as well.
Yeah. You can follow us on social media as well. We're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You could email us if you want. setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. And now, those credits. Setlist is presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an unlimited production.